We're doing our third class in the basics in Judaism, what we might call Judaism 101, and we had said that we would try to study a little bit to get an overview of some of the basic claims of the Kuzari. And the book of the Kuzari, we discussed last time, the king of Kuzar, he has this recurring dream, and then he pursues the message of the dream to seek out the religion which he can be convinced is true. Now, the story of the Kuzari, it seems, really happened. Whether the words were actually said the way they were recorded is a different question. And we see that the Christian and the Muslim, when they're interviewed, the philosopher, so they present their claim that they believe in the God that created the world. Whereas when the Jew is interviewed, so he says, "We believe in the God that took us out of Egypt," which the Kuzari is quick to pounce upon and assume that the Jew doesn't understand too much because that is the way he presents God. Now, the Jew then goes on to explain with a parable. And he says the following. He says, if I were to tell you that there was this country where, you know, there's this country, there are all these fine people in this country, and I were to tell you that their king is a very fine person, and he is the one that causes them to be such fine people. It is because of the king that they are who they are, and they're as good as they are, and would you be compelled to praise that king? And to that the king, the Kuzari, says, well, I wouldn't even know that such a king existed. Maybe he's not the cause of all the good actions of these people. And then the Jew asks him, and what would happen if I brought you a bunch of gifts and things that would cure your people and things that only a king of such a state could actually send you? Then what would you say? And then he says, well, then I would feel compelled because then I'd received such signs. So the simple reading of this parable is that Hashem's first connection with us as the Jewish people was the gift that Hashem gave us, the Exodus from Egypt, the miracles, and based on that, we have a first acquaintance from our perspective with God. And we discussed in our first class that there are numerous approaches to proving and to understanding that Hashem created the world. And we described that this is an approach that begins from within. But I would like us to take a step back and analyze this parable a little bit more closely. When the Jew asks the king, he says to him, there are these fine people, and I tell you that they have a fine king, would you feel compelled to praise the king? And the Kuzri responds, he says, well, I don't know if the king is really the cause for these people being so fine. Now, it seems that the people the Kuzri is acquainted with, the fact that these people are fine people, the Kuzri is in agreement with. The only question is, does this attribute of these people, does that stem from their king? But the fact that these people exist, that he doesn't question. The fact that there are fine people, that he is in agreement with. The only question where he starts saying, well, I wouldn't know if the cause for there being such fine people is the king. I wouldn't know if the king even exists, or if he really is the one that taught them to be such fine people. Well, that's a totally different question. You guys see where I'm headed? So what is Rabbi Yehuda Halevi really telling us? Before we reach the simple meaning of the allegory, before we reach the overt meaning, which is, well, God first met us through the gifts he gave us at Exodus, the Kuzri has already given us another understanding, another angle at seeing our Creator. And that is by looking at his people. And that's something which the Kuzri isn't saying overtly. You just have to read the parable closely. And I think you'll agree with me that that's included in the parable. Moshe, are we in agreement? Yeah, is this how you read the parable before tonight? I don't know. Yeah, that's how you read it? Okay, good.
Yeah.
Okay. So, yeah, Yehuda.
I just have a question. If I understand you correctly, doesn't the Kuzri first present Jewish people as a lowly, hated people that is not respected by anyone?
But that doesn't change whether they're good and kind or not. They're two different gauges. One is a question of, are they known as good and kind people? And the other is a question of whether the world looks up to them or looks down at them, whether the world tramples them or not, whether the UN is busy condemning them. Look at the states that are condemning them. You know, they put out a video. I was walking by, someone was playing it on their laptop, of the UN. They have a committee on human rights. So you see over there, Libya's on the committee. Countries that are murdering people right and left, that have a terrible record of human rights. And they're sitting there condemning the United States and Israel, and they're with a straight face. When I saw which countries were condemning the United States, at first I thought it was a comedy. Meaning I walked by, I see this guy looking at it, and I said, that's a comedy, right? And he said, no, that's really what happened at the UN. These are the countries that spoke, and these are the condemnations they made. So if we want to gauge whether the Jewish people are moral people or not, I don't think the UN is going to be the gauge of that. I think that there's one quote which I didn't get a chance to print out, but Emir Shema posted on the bulletin board. Did you guys read the speech about Israel being a rogue state? No?
By who? It says that by who? We need to be a rogue state or whatever, right?
Okay, so we'll post it. There was a debate that made headlines about 2 months ago.
It
was all over. About whether Israel is a rogue state or not. Bezrat Hashem, I'll post it on the bulletin board. I want to go over a few facts. Simple facts, which you guys can verify. I took them off the internet. I did a 5-minute search last night. Let's see. How many Jews are there in the world? So there are about 13 to 15 million. How many people are there in the world? About 6 billion. Okay. So, what percentage do we represent?
0.03.
We're about 2%. Right. Now, we are not 2%. I'm sorry. No. We are 0.2%. I'm sorry. 0.2%. 0.2. Now, what? How many Nobel Prizes for contributions? 22%. How many since the Holocaust? 29%. How many physics, chemistry, medicine, physiology in areas that assist the world? Over a fifth out of 502 Nobel Prizes.
123.
What? Okay. So we're over a fifth, right? Our percentage, meaning we exceeded by more than 100 times our representation, more than 200 times our representation. Encyclopedia Britannica. It's a respected encyclopedia. When they list great inventions, of the 267 individual inventors, you have more than 13. Be it Zoll, the defibrillator, the pacemaker, be it Land, instant photography, Gabor, holography, Ginsburg, videotape. If you take our representation in the population, and this is the smallest example, because we saw in other examples were represented 200 times our representation based on population. Over here, it's only 22 times. So our representation is disproportionate. But what interested me, I wasn't looking for all of this. That's the truth. I'm not so interested in how many Nobel Prizes we have for literature and Pulitzer Prizes for nonfiction. Our books, screenplays, newspapers, magazine articles. It's true that we're outrepresented there too. We're outrepresented also in architecture. in education, in mathematics, but that wasn't what interested me. The fact that Spinoza, Maimonides, Marx, Derrida, Ricardo, Friedman, the fact that there are so many, that also doesn't interest me in philosophy. In medicine starts interesting me, and in psychology, and when you start seeing areas of giving, that was what interested me. Philanthropy. I remember hearing these stats when I was still in high school. So in December 2004, Business Week listed America's 50 most generous benefactors. And at least 19 of them were Jewish families. So that's what interested me. Because what the Kuzri is saying is that you're going to see people that are kind and good people. I'm not sure that being overrepresented in Hollywood means that we're kind and good people. That you could argue about. I'm not sure the Nobel Prizes are about being kind and good people. But when you start seeing in medicine, and when you start seeing in philanthropy, and when you see the charitable donations that total over $10 billion in less than 5 years, and that over 90% of those donations went to secular causes. We're not talking about going to Jewish institutions. We're talking about going to education, healthcare, medicine, humanities. So it turns out that 38% of America's most philanthropic people come from a group that represent only 2% of America's population, 0.2% of the world, 2% of America. Jews. Now, yeah. Now, there's one more point for the sake of honesty that we have to point out, and that is that these numbers never take into account how many of these are halachic Jews. Meaning, we say Jewish families, how many of these are intermarried, how many of these are halachically Jewish, and how many aren't. That's something which also is a point to ponder, and that's why I don't feel like this is the greatest proof to the point. I think that here we go to another point that we have to contemplate, and that is that there are areas where we would be more comfortable if we had a statistic, meaning I could walk away from these quotes and make believe that I've statistically proven that the Jewish people are kind and good and giving people. I don't think I've done that, in all honesty. I think that the truth, on the other hand, is not only about statistics, where we all know Mark Twain's lies about his line about white lies and gruesome lies and then terrible, terrible statistics. Statistics can be twisted, and so I'm not saying this is the point. I think that the point is found more on a personal level when you start looking and seeing the lives. Where you could look at the statistics on crime in Jewish communities. I'm not saying there isn't white-collar crime. I'm not saying Jews haven't swindled tons of money in many, many areas that they serve. I'm saying overall, there is an impression in the world that I think is constant from the days of the Kuzari to our days. And I think that that's something that few people who are honest and are aware of what's going on in the world would contend with that. There was once a council meeting where a woman stood up and spoke about how harmful the fact that the Jews are entering the town, how harmful it is. And one rabbi stood up and asked her, he said, I want you to imagine that you're standing in an alleyway, it's 2 o'clock in the morning, and suddenly you look up the alleyway and you see the figure you just described. You see a hat, you see a big jacket, you see a burly man standing there, and start approach towards you, and you have no way out, it's a dead end. And as he approaches, suddenly there's a glimpse of light, and you see it's a rabbi, he's got a long beard, and are you still worried, in all honesty? In all honesty, there's a reason why Jews can't live in Arab lands, but Arabs feel very free living among us. It's one of the big problems Israeli society has today. You have in Maalot, you have throughout the north. I've been getting emails from people who actually are finding themselves with neighbors next door who are Arabs. The Arabs feel very comfortable here. When was the last time a Jew burnt down an Arab house? When was the last time a Jew did anything close to what the Arabs did to us? Arab children walk around freely here. I still remember the day when they found the two children who, by mistake, came across a group of Arabs and they found their blood all over the cave. I'm just saying, I think that this is a point that the Kuzari makes, which in truth doesn't need so much support. It's something which is pretty much a given. It's something which I think the world is aware of. And it's not the type of argument we would like, because I think we would all like something more concrete. Give me statistics. We all felt more comfortable when I was quoting numbers off a piece of paper that sounded more believable. But I think in all honesty, if we think about it, that doesn't make this argument less valid. The fact that we can't point to numbers and yet we can point to things that are pretty well known, and are pretty agreed upon as far as the Jews in the world and their activities in the world. And I'm not quoting the numerous examples of where the state of Israel went out to help other countries, and I don't think that proves the point. I think the point is proven on an individual basis. When we think about the families, when we think about the people and the lives that people lead. And again, I'm not saying Jews don't commit crimes. I'm not saying Jews are perfect people. But when the Kuzari gives an example of a people who are good, and the only question is, are they good because of their king or not? And then he says, okay, so wait, I'll illustrate to you their connection to the king. I'll show you that the king exists. And once you see that, then it makes sense. It's logical that he is the cause behind their being such good people. I think that even though the thrust of his argument is about our connection to Hashem and Yetziat Mitzrayim, and that is the first point where Hashem revealed himself, I think there's also a point which we can recognize about the Jews being good, kind, giving people, and that is the reputation we have. As much as the world tries to besmirch us, there's another point which is sometimes confused with this point. Once we're discussing this, I want us to touch on that, even though it's not in the Kuzari directly. It is in the Rambam, in the Rambam's Yemenite epistle, Igeret Teiman. We got 3 minutes. I'm with you. Go ahead, Mike.
Okay. Oh, good. You think money, though, is a reasonable guide as to whether people are really kind? Like, some rich people give a load of money, but they always want the name in the paper.
I'm with you. I agree. I think there are many flaws, and if this were my proof,
some rich people give it for tax, and then they want to go look at me. I'm good.
I'm with you.
And then they get knighthood for it, or stuff like that.
I'm not contesting that. Quite the contrary. I'm saying if this were all that it was based on, I wouldn't be saying it because I don't think this proves anything.
I agree.
I think it's the reputation. It's the individual. Coming in contact that we have and what we see around us. It's a reputation that a people make over a few thousand years.
But also, isn't it a bit dangerous because under Muslim law, they're meant to give 10%, is that right? So even if only some of them bothered to, because there's so many of them, the capital amount that they would be giving would be a lot more.
Fine.
Even though,
let's see those numbers.
Yeah, okay.
Let's see what they're supporting with those numbers. What's called charity by them?
I have no idea.
Okay.
Well, actually, yeah, I do, and you don't want to know.
Okay. Yes.
I was just saying that once you look around, take a look at the individual's families, and you see that everyone, it's widely accepted that Jews are charitable people, then the statistics do matter, because they're based off knowing these people are charitable people, so you can say when they donate money, it's not because of this and that, that you've already...
Okay, if it makes you feel good. I don't see it the way you do, but I can see that we differ. I'm more of a cynic. I don't. Fine. But I want us to mention one more point. The Rambam writes, and this is a line which we find in different Rishonim, and again, this runs the realm of something which is not so easily provable in a logical manner. It's not about 1 + 1 = 2. It's not about statistics, but the Rambam writes that when you compare Judaism with Islam and Christianity, the only person who can say they're similar is someone who looks with an external eye and says, well, here there are laws, and here there are laws, and here there are laws, and here they say something's permitted and something's prohibited, and here they're saying something's permitted and something's prohibited, so I guess they're all similar. And that's similar to a person standing and looking at different creatures and saying, well, this one has a nose and this one has hands and this one's hands feet, so I guess they're similar. Ah, but this one's from the animal kingdom, he's called a monkey, and this one's from the human kingdom, he's called a human being. Are we going to say they're similar because they're built similar? The Rambam says, once you see internally, you see the heart and you see the life that Judaism gives a person, and then you try to compare that with what really exists in the other religions, you start seeing this is a lifeless body and this is a body filled with life. And that's something which can be seen from within, and the Rambam doesn't even, he says it as a point in passing. He says this is something which is obvious once you begin understanding what each religion is all about, but he mentions it as a point in passing because, again, this is something which I could be sitting up here and say the same thing about Christianity and the same thing about Islam. Go prove it. Meaning this is something which I want you guys to think about, which is what we said at the onset of our learning, that some of these points are going to be thoughts that need to be digested. And just because I cannot prove something in a numerical or a way that's logical using the laws of logic doesn't mean that what we're saying cannot be perceived as true. You guys with me on that? It just means you have to think about it. And we discussed last week or last time we were learning that there are going to be two points here. We're going to discuss the logical approaches. Now we're still going to discuss the 7-day week. We're still going to discuss Yetzias Mitzrayim. We're still going to discuss a lot of things. But there is another aspect which is not less important and quite possibly more important, which is what we connect to. It's not only about what we can prove, it's also about what we can understand and what we can connect to. Not everything that we can understand can be proven in a logical manner. I understand that I see you there. Now, can I explain to you how my retina perceives the reflection of light off of you and how that's processed with the mind and then the signals? And I can't. So there are things that we can understand, we can perceive, and yet we cannot explain. Our understanding is not limited to that which we can explain. You guys with me on that? Yes? No? Maybe so? I see blank faces. Okay, so think about it. And you guys can tell me if what we discussed tonight wasn't clear. We'll get back to it again next week, Ms. Achin. Okay.